The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating over 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business.
On June 9, 2009, Ambassador Stephen W. Bosworth, Special Representative for North Korea Policy, addressed members and supporters of the Korea Society at the organization's annual dinner in New York City. Ambassador Bosworth is introduced by Evans J.R. Revere, the president of the Korea Society.
It is now my very great pleasure to introduce tonight's keynote speaker. I have known Ambassador Steve Bosworth for, my goodness, almost three decades. We're getting old. When we first met, I was a lowly junior officer working for the State Department, and he was already a prominent senior State Department official with a very well-deserved reputation for being able to take on any task and handle it brilliantly. Back in those days, we worked together on Latin American issues at a time when that portfolio was one of the most controversial areas of U.S. diplomatic endeavor. In the midst of all of the chaos and controversy of those days, he was like a rock. And this young, impressionable diplomat learned something from that. We crossed paths again when I was working on U.S.-Japan relations, and he was heading the U.S.-Japan Foundation during a period when U.S.-Japan relations were very much in the news and not necessarily in a good way. Once again, his steady hand was very much in evidence in contributing to growth and stability in U.S.-Japan ties at a very important juncture. And we worked together again. You see a pattern here. This time on Korea, when he was at the helm of our embassy in Seoul during the Asian financial crisis. Ladies and gentlemen, if you ask anyone who knows how difficult those days were in Korea, they will tell you what I am about to tell you right now, which is without Ambassador Steve Bosworth's judgment, his wisdom, and his steady hand, Korea would not have managed its way through those dark days. I learned a lot of lessons, important lessons, from him, including as his deputy in Seoul. The most important thing I learned from him was that one diplomat with a conscience, with courage, and with vision can make a profound difference in shaping an alliance, building a partnership, and dealing with seemingly insurmountable challenges. Today, Ambassador Bosworth has once again been asked by his president to serve, this time in managing one of the most intractable foreign policy challenges our country faces. Ladies and gentlemen, President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton are fortunate to have a man of such caliber and capability on their team. And ladies and gentlemen, we as Americans are lucky to have him working on behalf of the United States of America. Please join me in welcoming Ambassador Stephen W. Bosworth.
It's a long way around to the podium. And as Evans has just indicated, it's been a long way around for me. Chris and I in years past, have looked forward very much to this annual dinner of the Korea Society. It gave us an opportunity to renew our ties with Korea and to see many, many old friends. So I am particularly honored to be asked to be the keynote speaker this evening at this annual dinner of the Korea Society. And I want to thank you, Evans, and thank you for your kind introduction, too kind. I'm honored to be here tonight with my former boss, the Honorable Henry Kissinger, the Honorable Governor Sonny Perdue of Georgia, the Honorable Governor Bob Riley from Alabama, His Excellency Ambassador Hyun-Kyun Kim, His Excellency Ambassador Park In-guk, with whom I worked very closely in my time at Cato when we were actually building nuclear reactors in North Korea. And I would like to acknowledge and congratulate Mr. Chung Mong-ku, Chairman of the Kia Automotive Group. I would like to acknowledge the Korea Society for the wonderful work that they have done over the years under the leadership of Don Gregg and now under the leadership of Evans Revere as they fulfill their mission of producing greater awareness and understanding and cooperation between the people of the United States and the people of Korea. I was very honored, very flattered to be asked to take on this position by Secretary Clinton and President Obama. I will confess, however, that in the last several weeks, I have occasionally questioned my judgment in accepting. This has not been an easy time, and I suspect it will not become an easy time in the next few months. As I think will be apparent from my remarks, however, I remain, in the long term, a cautious optimism about our ability to resolve these problems. The past few weeks have seen a tremendous amount of action on North Korean issues, including on April 5, the firing of the Taepodong 2 and the resulting UN Security Council action. Then on May 25, a nuclear test and additional missile launches, which will now be responded to by a unified effort from the UN Security Council. In addition, two young American journalists have been detained in North Korea for several weeks and have now been sentenced to imprisonment. We urge that the DPRK release these young women on humanitarian grounds. Before I focus on the current situation in North Korea, I would like to look briefly at the East Asia region as a whole, highlighting in this regard the close cooperation of the United States, the Republic of Korea, Japan, China, and Russia, as we work together toward the common goal of a denuclearized Korean Peninsula. In my remarks this evening, I would like to expand on the importance of our relations with our two alliance partners, the Republic of Korea and Japan, and our relations with China and Russia. I would also like to comment briefly on the current situation in North Korea and to lay out a vision for a Northeast Asia that can be at once peaceful, prosperous, cooperative, and secure. In the 20th century, George Kennan identified Northeast Asia together with Western Europe as the two regions of primary geopolitical importance for the United States. Kennan's observation about Northeast Asia seems increasingly prescient in the 21st century, just as events in Europe greatly influenced global developments in the world of the 20th century, so we look to Asia as a harbinger of what the 21st century will bring. With 60% of the world's population, the world's second and third largest national economies, and an increasing percentage of global trade, Asia has evolved over the past few decades into a strategic center point, both economically and geopolitically. For reasons of both history and national interest, the United States regards itself as a resident power in East Asia. Our interests in the region are permanent and profound. They center on our relationships with our two alliance partners, the Republic of Korea and Japan, and increasingly with China. Our relationships with South Korea and Japan both began with formal military alliances, which continue to serve as a foundation for increasingly expansive bilateral ties. Both alliances have evolved based on shared values to encompass a wide range of issues, including a common commitment to political freedom, economic prosperity, and regional and global cooperation. Let me start with the Republic of Korea. Our relationship with Korea was strong when I was the U.S. ambassador in Seoul, but it has grown even stronger over the past decade. And our close cooperation with South Korea, demonstrated again over the past few weeks, exemplifies how the security relationship between our two countries continues to anchor our broader bilateral ties. What began with a stronger nation protecting a weaker one has evolved dramatically as South Korea has become a developed country with a highly capable military, a sophisticated economy, and an increasingly global strategic perspective. Our military alliance is now a more balanced partnership, with the ROK military ready to assume primary responsibility for South Korean defense. In 2012, South Korea will assume wartime operational control of its troops, a significant step that demonstrates Korea's increasing maturity and our partnership. Working in concert with our partners in Seoul, we are realigning our troops, consolidating our bases, and shifting command responsibility to South Korea's armed forces, while enhancing our capacity to defend the peninsula in time of crisis. Our mutual goal is for the United States to field a more tailored force with a smaller footprint that creates less of an impact on South Korean civilians, but which still provides the deterrent necessary to maintain peace on the peninsula. We are in the process of relocating U.S. military bases away from the centers of large cities and fielding a leaner, more flexible fighting force. It is worth noting that the U.S.-ROK alliance has matured to the point where we are equally concerned with working together to provide to others the security our two countries have enjoyed for the past 50 years. U.S. and Korean forces have worked side by side in international peacekeeping and military operations in Lebanon, Iraq, and Afghanistan. A South Korean warship is working with the U.S. and other like-minded nations to prevent piracy in international waters off the Horn of Africa. That we are able to look beyond our own security needs is a mark of the maturity and increasingly global nature of our alliance. Our political alliance with the Republic of Korea is strongly buttressed by our growing economic ties. To that end, in 2007, the U.S. and Korea concluded negotiations for a free trade agreement. Recognizing that a sound free trade agreement could offer benefits to both countries, President Obama and President Lee committed to working together to chart a way forward on this at their meeting in London on April 2nd. Most important are the strong ties between the people of the United States and the people of the Republic of Korea. More than 100,000 students from Korea enrich American classrooms each year. We at Tufts University and the Fletcher School are fortunate to have a number of them in our classrooms. This makes South Koreans, the largest group of foreign students studying in the United States. To encourage more students to take part in similar experiences, last year, the governments of our two countries signed a memorandum of understanding on the Work English Study Travel Program, WEST, that allows Korean young people to come to the United States to study English, work at a professional internship, and travel on a single visa. Nearly 200 Korean students and recent graduates are currently in the United States taking advantage of this opportunity. A small but increasing number of Americans are choosing to study in Korea. The State Department now offers grants for students from the secondary through postgraduate levels to study Korean. The Fulbright program offers recent college graduates the opportunity to teach English abroad for a year in select countries through its English Teaching Assistant program. The program in South Korea has been the most successful in East Asia. Alumni of this program and others like it are part of a growing cadre of the next generation of U.S.-Korean studies experts. In another important development beginning in January of this year, South Koreans are permitted to travel to the United States under the Visa Waiver Program, which allows South Koreans, citizens who enter the United States for personal travel or business, to stay up to 90 days without a visa. And I must say, as someone who was in Korea when we were issuing something like 600,000 visas a year, this has been a boon not only for South Korea, but also for the United States, and in particular, the U.S. Embassy in Seoul. When Presidents Lee and Obama meet next week, they will chart a vision for a U.S.-ROK relationship that is based on strong bilateral cooperation, but aims to expand that cooperation to address challenges around the globe, ranging from the global financial crisis to combating global climate change. Likewise, nearly 50 years have passed since the United States and Japan signed the Treaty on Mutual Cooperation and Security, the foundation of our strategic alliance. We share a strong and vital relationship based on shared interests, values, and a common vision for the future. As the leading democracies and economies in the world, the United States and Japan have shared interests that cut across a range of difficult issues. From our commitment to peace and stability in the Asia-Pacific region to our efforts to push for economic growth in the midst of the global worldwide financial crisis, and from our work to counter the scourge of terrorism to our shared interest in mitigating the impact of climate change. It is clear that the issues that we face today are more global in nature than ever before. These transnational issues cannot be resolved by the United States or Japan alone, not even by the international community that does not include leadership from both the United States and Japan. Our alliance continues to evolve to adapt to the global nature of our challenges. We are strengthening communication, collaboration, and coordination. Japan's support to Operation Enduring Freedom has been important to the coalition mission in Afghanistan. Japan's dispatch of two maritime self-defense force vessels to the Gulf of Aden is an important step in the fight against piracy. And of course, the United States continues to support strongly Japan's efforts to ascertain the fate of its missing citizens who were abducted by the North Koreans. China. As China has become a global economic power, its political and diplomatic influence is increasing as well. It is one of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council and is a key member of vital regional and international organizations, APEC, the ASEAN Regional Forum, the G20, the WTO, and the Nuclear Suppliers Group. Accordingly, the importance of United States-China relations continues to rise as well. When President Richard Nixon and then Secretary of State Henry Kissinger made their historic visit to China in February of 1972, it would have been hard to imagine the breadth and depth of the issues we now discuss bilaterally with China on a regular basis. The Obama administration is determined to grow and build a positive, cooperative relationship that reflects the increasingly complex and comprehensive nature of our relations with China. We currently convene over 50 bilateral dialogues and working groups spanning subjects from aviation to counterterrorism to food safety and nonproliferation. When President Obama met with President Hu Jintao on the margins of the G20 summit in London in April, they agreed to seek positive, cooperative, and comprehensive relations. Many of the major challenges facing the world today cannot be successfully addressed without the involvement and assistance of China. We are planning to launch the Strategic and Economic Dialogue in Washington this July in order to maximize opportunities for bilateral cooperation that can be better revealed by a strategic whole-of-government approach to the relationship. Secretary Clinton's February visit to Beijing and Treasury Secretary Geithner's visit last week helped to lay the groundwork for this new dialogue, which will be based on mutual respect, cooperation, and a long-term perspective. Against the backdrop of a prosperous and dynamic region, North Korea presents a stark contrast. President Obama came into office committed to a willingness to talk directly to countries with whom we have differences and to try to resolve those differences. This commitment to dialogue was communicated directly to North Korea in the president's first days in office. This administration has repeatedly signaled a desire to pick up on the progress made by the six-party process, to continue bilateral dialogue, and to work toward denuclearization and a normal relationship with North Korea. To date, we have had absolutely no positive response to these signals. In fact, North Korea's actions and statements run directly counter to the goals of regional peace and security. The North Koreans have renounced their six-party commitments to the disablement of their nuclear program, and through their missile and nuclear tests, have defied the UN Security Council and violated the provisions of the Security Council Resolution 1718. As President Obama said in response to the May 25th nuclear test, North Korea is directly and recklessly challenging the international community. This is a challenge that the international community must meet. We call on the DPRK, therefore, to refrain from further provocative actions, to uphold its commitments, and to abide by its international obligations. North Korea will not find international acceptance unless it abandons its pursuit of weapons of mass destruction and their means of delivery. Last week, I participated in an interagency trip led by Deputy Secretary of State James Steinberg to consult in depth with our Asian partners in response to North Korea's recent statements and actions. These discussions were very productive. They reinforced our unity and commitment to coordination with our allies and partners in dealing with the challenges coming from North Korea. North Korea's nuclear threat is not a problem for the United States alone. It is a threat to the ROK, Japan, China, and Russia, and the broader international community. Therefore, we must all be part of the solution aimed at maintaining peace and establishing lasting stability in the region. We have also conducted intensive consultations here in New York at the UN Security Council. These discussions are ongoing, and Ambassador Rice continues to work with her colleagues in the Security Council to craft a strong, unequivocal, and unified response to North Korea's violation of its obligations under a new binding Security Council resolution, which we have all agreed is required. The United States shares with our allies, the Republic of Korea and Japan, and with China and Russia, a fundamental interest in improving stability and security in the region through the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. This basic goal of the United States, the complete and verifiable denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, remains unchanged. And I cannot imagine a situation in which we would modify that goal. North Korea has announced its withdrawal from the six-party talks, but we and the other participants in the talks are committed to work through this process to implement the principles of the September 2005 joint statement. Notwithstanding North Korea's recent actions, we and our partners in the talks remain open to meaningful dialogue and serious negotiation. As we have indicated to Pyongyang, the United States also remains open to bilateral dialogue and negotiation as part of this multilateral effort. North Korea's recent actions to develop a nuclear capacity and intercontinental ballistic missile capacity will require that we expand our consideration of possible responses, including our force posture and options for extended deterrence. However, the North Korean claim to be responding to a threat or a hostile policy by the United States is simply groundless. Quite to the contrary, we have no intention to invade North Korea or to change its regime through force, and we have made this clear to the DPRK repeatedly. We are convinced that negotiation and dialogue are the best means available to achieve the goal of complete and verifiable denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Future negotiations, however, need to establish the irreversible steps that North Korea must take to go beyond the impermanent disablement actions previously taken. In short, we remain ready for serious negotiations with North Korea. Though denuclearization is vital and remains our prime and most necessary objective, it should not be the exclusive focus of our talks. North Korea should be shown a clear path toward acceptance in the international community. In joining that international community, North Korea must live up to international standards, including with regards to respecting the human rights of its own people. The Northeast Asia of the future will include a denuclearized North Korea, a peace regime on the Korean Peninsula to replace the armistice of 1953, and normal interlocking relations among all countries, including the DPRK and the United States. It should be a region of open borders and a free flow of communication, ideas, and travelers. No nuclear weapons will threaten that region, and economic cooperation and integration will provide all with opportunities for prosperity. Before North Korea began backing away from its commitments and then taking a series of provocative actions, the six-party talks had made progress toward achieving the vision that I've just outlined. These talks provided a platform for engagement and dialogue that helps to build mutual trust and understanding. Each member of the six-party process was able to raise issues of concern and seek common ground. Each of us will continue to have differences and disagreements with North Korea, but we all understand that negotiation and dialogue are the best tools with which to resolve these. Building a foundation of mutual trust and transparency will facilitate continued growth and prosperity in the region and make it possible for the people of North Korea to share in that prosperity. By continuing to threaten and alienate its neighbors, North Korea will deny itself the security and respect it claims to be seeking. For the United States, of course, we will do what we must do in order to provide for our own security and that of our allies. It is indeed North Korea that faces fundamental choices. It can remain in the darkness of its cave and see the world only in shadows on the wall. Or it can come out into the light and join the international community. We will welcome the day when North Korea chooses to come out of its cave, and we will be prepared to receive them. Thank you very much.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, or management. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Korea Society. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for more information about memberships and to learn more about the programs available at the Korea Society.